Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights, a podcast brought to you by the Society of Entrepreneurs and hosted by Pearson Crutcher and Jay Healy. The Society of Entrepreneurs is a membership organization founded to promote entrepreneurship and provide education and resources to Memphis business owners.
In this podcast, we'll have a series of interviews with accomplished business owners and entrepreneurs in Memphis, Tennessee. There are so many great entrepreneurs in Memphis, and their stories need to be told.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. Today's interview is with Gary Dodson. Gary is the CEO of 10Techs, which is a series of truck dealerships and service centers operating in multiple states in the Mid-South.
Gary shares some great insights in how he's improved his leadership skills over time and how that's brought significant success to his company. He also knows quite a bit about electronic vehicles and autonomous driving, and he shares what he thinks is the future for trucking. We hope you enjoy our interview with Gary Dodson.
Welcome to Entrepreneurial Insights. We are so excited today to have Gary Dodson with us. Gary is the CEO of
10Techs.
Okay, I was like, I don't remember the name now. It used to be Tag,
and right. It is. Well, it's 10Techs currently. We still use the Tag name in our local area, but we merged with another group that's called Lone Star Truck Group. That's based out of Texas. And we merged the two companies, and the holding company that owns both of those is called 10Techs, TNTX, for Tennessee, Texas. My wife created the name because we couldn't figure anything out, but it was just a holding company name that we created, and we're not marketing the name. It's just the holding company, so I'm the CEO of 10Techs.
10Techs, but Tag is still...
But we own Tag and Lone Star, so... Effectively, I'm the CEO of the whole company. Yep.
And how would you describe the business? Who do you serve? What do you provide for them?
We're like a car dealer for big trucks, for 18-wheelers. So we sell trucks, trailers, medium-duty trucks, sprinter vans. We do some other stuff with battery electric, yard spotters, panel vans for FedEx. Our biggest customer is probably FedEx, but it's in various... buckets. We do a lot of work with Express, but we do a lot of work with Ground, and they're independent owner operators. And we also do a lot of work with Freight out of Arkansas as well. So we sell parts, we work on trucks, we fix trucks. So we have parts people, mechanics, and truck salesmen that sell new, used, and trailers as well.
Wow. And then how many locations do you have now?
I mean, it depends on what you define as a dealership. True dealerships, we've probably got 25 locations in 9 states. You know, Texas, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Missouri, Kentucky. So we've got a wide map.
But mostly the South.
Mostly, yeah. A Mid-South is what we would call it.
And when did you start the company?
So I moved here. So I grew up in Dallas and worked, and I'm an accountant by training. So I went to work for a truck dealership. I lost a poker bet and a buddy of mine. Then the loss of the poker bet led to me interviewing with a truck dealer. And the truck dealer was financially struggling. And I felt that I always wanted to own my own business. So I felt this could be a business that I could buy at some point in time. And so I came and became his CFO, got him refinanced, and basically got him out of trouble, and then he sold it to somebody else. So I got stuck. But I wound up working for a company called Murphy Hoffman Company, which is based out of Kansas City. And they were, at that point in time, they were the largest truck dealer in the nation. And I learned a lot about the truck dealership from them. They were very good at it. I stayed with them for about 7 or 8 years, and then met a gentleman by the name of Dan Stevens, who was kind of my mentor. He was the chief operating officer of MHC, or one of them. So I worked for them. Then I went to work for another company in Denver and lived there for a couple of years called Stewart & Stevenson, which is kind of an engine distributor company. And Dan Stevens came here and worked for a company called Barlow World, which owned 12 dealerships and Dan recruited me from where I was in Denver to come here to live and be the basically the VP of operations for the East region of Barlow World, which was Memphis and the surrounding areas. And Barlow World was an interesting company that was based in South Africa. At one point, they were the largest Heister dealer in the country.
Heister being?
Heister forklifts.
Okay.
And they did a lot of business with FedEx and, you know, all the other logistics companies around here. They were based in Charlotte, but they were, the U.S. operations were based in Charlotte, but they were owned by a South African conglomerate. And so apartheid was going on in the 06, 07 timeframe, and all the South African companies were very fearful about getting their assets basically taken over by the government, nationalizing it or whatever. So they were taking money out of South Africa and putting it in the U.S., and they were buying everything they could buy and paid way, way too much money for what they bought. So when apartheid went away and Mandela basically made peace with the businesses, they started taking money back to South Africa, and they decided they wanted to get out of the truck business. So they basically put us up for sale. Tommy and I, Tommy Earl, my partner, made an offer for four of the dealerships. At that point, it was Memphis, Jackson, Tennessee, Jonesboro, Arkansas, and Tupelo. So we made an offer to purchase those dealerships, and we lost the offer. It was the actually the Dobbs Group, John Dobbs Jr., they won the bid, and they were in the midst of, so we went through 3 to 4 months of due diligence from Dobbs, and the South African company basically got fed up with the process, and they said, we're going to open it up to bids again. Are you guys still interested? And we were the only part of the group. So there was 12 dealerships, and they were basically, it was broken up into three groups. There was a Little Rock group, a Texarkana group, and our group. Our group was the only one that had a significant amount of real estate owned. We were the only one that had to come up with a lot of money. And the guy's name was Brandon Diamond. He came to me and he said, hey, can you get this deal financed? And I didn't know whether I could or not, but I lied and told him we could. And, you know, kind of the rest is history.
What year was that final transaction? It was 07.
Okay. When we bought it.
Right.
And we bought four dealerships at that point in time.
Yeah. It's not uncommon that sometimes the second offer becomes the final offer, right?
Right. Correct. Yeah. And as I said, they paid way too much money for the business when they bought it.
Yeah.
The real estate debacle happened or was happening or starting at that point in time. And I think they wound up, you know, writing off $30 or $40 million in goodwill that they had paid for the dealerships. It was lucky. You know, we were in the right place at the right time.
And so how have you expanded from four dealerships to where you are today?
So at that point in time, FedEx was really probably 50 to 60% of our business. And we got somewhat fearful. You know, FedEx is a great customer, and we really appreciate everything they do, but having all your eggs in that basket can get kind of scary at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to buy five additional dealerships, and that happened in 2011. We bought four. It was called Duckett Truck Center, and it was another Freightliner dealer. Mm-hmm. And we bought four in Missouri and one in Kentucky, Calvert City, Kentucky, and then Poplar Bluff, Sikeston, Jackson, and Farmington. So we bought those four dealerships in 2011 and have been operating them since. So, you know, you had the four dealerships that we had started with, and they were called TAG, and then another five that we bought, they called it MoTag because it was in Missouri. So
right.
It was MoTag.
Okay.
And then that's kind of really where we thought it was kind of big enough for us. So we kind of stopped there. And we'd always had a relationship. So the three groups that the Barlow that broke up into, we only had like 45 days to close the transaction. So we didn't have a business system. We didn't have the infrastructure in place to run the business. So So the Lone Star Truck Group, which was based in Texas, had that. They were already a functioning dealer group. They had the software that was needed to run the business, you know, that kind of stuff. So basically, they were minority partners initially in our group, and they helped us through the approval process with Daimler. So we kind of tagged on to their business system and had always had a relationship with them. So they did all of our safety training. They did all our IT support, everything, you know, related to the day-to-day running of the business. So we'd always had a relationship with Lone Star. And then Daimler, OEMs like to deal with less people. So they don't like to have, you know, 100 dealers out, you know, that they have to call 100 people and tell them we're going to change this policy or that policy. So they were touting consolidation. So in 2018, us and the Lone Star Group started talking about, you know, what would we look like if we merged? So we started those conversations. Tommy and I had done a little better job conserving capital. So we wound up being worth more than the Lone Star Group when you looked at us. So we wound up being in a position where we would, you know, have control. So we thought that a merger would make sense.
Yeah.
And I remember when you were inducted into the society, the dealership that I came to see you was Brooks, wasn't it?
Brooks Road, yeah.
But now you have the beautiful new facility of Von American Way.
We're the Mall of Memphis, yeah.
And that's exactly right.
So. Yeah, we built that in really right before, I think our first day was January 1st, 18. And we merged with Lone Star in 2018. So we went from a 50,000 square foot facility on Brooks Road to a 200,000 square foot facility on the mall, former Mall of Memphis property. We thought we were insane. We thought we built it so big that we would never outrun it. But ever since we built it, I mean, it started day one. I mean, we filled all the offices and we were inundated by customer business.
Oh, really?
So obviously we were stupid for staying in a small building and not, you know, we didn't know how much pent-up demand there was for quality truck service, quite honestly.
Right. So it seems like, you know, I'm observing from quite a distance because I don't buy trucks, but just following you in Memphis business news and seeing the trajectory that you're on and that you've accomplished, it seems like you have expanded beyond what people might have thought was reasonable for a truck dealer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tommy and I get up every morning and pinch ourselves and go, you know, is this a dream? You know, obviously Memphis from a logistics perspective.
Sure.
I mean, as my dad would say, I mean, you know, my dad, the first time he drove from Dallas to Memphis and he goes, what business are you in? I said, I'm in the trucking business. He said, well, based on the traffic that I've seen on I-40, you'd have to be an idiot to bankrupt this company. So, I mean, the market is solid here, obviously, and we've had more growth than I would have ever anticipated. I mean, we were doing well. You know, we sold our first year, you know, we sold probably $150 million in sales and made reasonable profit for Tommy and I. So, you know, it was a good investment on our part. But, you know, now we're, you know, $1 billion a year company with, you know, 1,300 employees. I mean, you know, it's somewhat mind-boggling the growth that we've had over the 14 years.
Did you achieve that by doing things differently than other people in your industry or?
Well, I think the Mall of Memphis change was huge. In the old building, we were very hard to do business with. I mean, we didn't have enough parking. We couldn't, you know, if a customer came in, they didn't have a place to park their trailer. So we would tell them to go down the road, pay somebody to take your trailer and then come back and see us and we'll fix your truck. I mean, you know, if you wanted body shop work, we had a place in West Memphis. That was the body shop. So we would send the customer, well, we'll fix this part here, but we've got to send it to West Memphis.
And right.
Although, you know, what they say about lipstick on a pig or whatever. I mean, we tried to pretty it up as much as we could, but it was not a good place to be. We were in multiple buildings across the street. It was very hard to communicate. It was just really hard to do business there. So when we built the Mall of Memphis property, you know, everything, I think, like we talk about elite support, and that's kind of a, it's a program that, that Daimler purports, and it's Six Sigma and what they call express assessment and speeding the time. You know, our job is to decrease the length of time that a driver has to be in our dealership. Right. So if you're managing that process, it's much easier to do it if your building is built in a way that you can do that. Sure. Our old building was not that way. Right. So, and as a result, we built a new building in Tupelo 2 years ago now. We overbuilt it, but we built it kind of in the same thought process as the Memphis facility. It's changed Tupelo. I mean, Tupelo's business has doubled in a matter of a year.
Oh.
Wow.
And we had a facility there, but the facility was hard. I mean, it was hard to get to. It wasn't on the highway. It wasn't visible. And, you know, the new facility, I don't know, you've probably seen it if you've driven to Florida, but it's a beautiful facility.
Oh, I haven't seen that one, but I saw the new one in Jackson, Tennessee the other day when I was there.
And you know, and we've bought a property there and are going to build a new building there as well that's going to be on the interstate. Closer okay. to, so we'll have visibility. And we expect the same type of growth in Jackson as we've seen in Tupelo.
Well, we certainly know from the pandemic and all of the supply chain issues that we're having these days how important it is to keep the trucks on the road, because we don't get our products if we don't have trucks on the road. So how has the pandemic affected your business?
We've had part shortages. We're having trouble getting trucks. You know, at one point, Daimler was saying that they had 12,000 trucks parked waiting on this part or that part. That number has come down pretty significantly. I think it's down to like 3,500, something like that. But it's still a huge, huge number. It's been difficult. I would say that the biggest difficulty is, you know, providing clear direction and communication to the people that work for you when you don't really know what's going on. You know, at first, when it first started, we didn't even know if we were going to be open. We didn't know if we were going to be essential or, you know, an essential business. And the dealer groups that we deal with, you know, the Tennessee Truck Association, they went to the, you know, the federal government and said, hey, all of these truck dealerships need to be open or you yeah. people are not going to survive. So we had a lot of support in that regard. But, I mean, it's just been really difficult seeing people, you know, struggle with COVID, you know, and just managing fear more than anything. I mean, people were scared to have somebody in front of them talking to them, you know, for fear that, you know, and we're in a sales business. So, you know, we're always talking to people and people are always in front of us and we don't know where they've been. And, you know, you don't know if they're vaccinated or blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's, you just have to manage fear. And, you know, really the only way to do that is to be there with them as it's going on. So, I mean, we didn't go hide and work from home. We didn't do that because we didn't feel like it was appropriate because we're requiring them to be in front of people that sense. we had to be in the same place. So, I mean, it's been difficult, but, you know, to be honest with you, our last 2 years have been the best years that our company's had. So from a profit perspective, it's been really good, but probably from a career perspective, it's been the hardest couple of years that I've been through just because, you know, there's so much uncertainty, you know, every day there's something new, you know, like obviously the Supreme Court knocked it down, but this whole vaccination thing about having to require people to vaccinate. So we had the state of Tennessee saying that you couldn't ask people if they were vaccinated. And then you had Biden say,
you have to
vaccinate. And I was like, well, what do, and then you got people coming in your door and say, well, what are we going to do? You know, half of our techs will quit if we require them to vaccinate, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, you know, it's just been something new. You know, every 30 days, there's something new. So, you know, hopefully we'll get to a point where it's kind of back to normal. You know, I don't know how long that's going to be. You know, I saw an economist, we were nominated for a dealer of the year by a
congratulations.
Magazine. Thank you. By Successful Dealer. And I went to that presentation in Phoenix. We didn't win it, but we were nominated. But an economist was there, and it's an economist that's on CNBC or whatever. And he basically said that there's basically, we've created 5 years of backlog it's going to take us 5 years to catch up because we've basically not, we're not able to sell trucks to people that need them. And they've got old trucks that they're having to fix, and their price, they're basically their cost per mile is going up. So they want to, you know, we're extending the life of all of these trucks. At some point, they're going to have to be replaced, but it's, you know, they can't produce enough today to do that. I mean, they're even cutting how many trucks we get just because they can't get chips or DPF filters are a problem, sensors, that type of stuff.
What are DPF filters?
It's the diesel fluid. It's what makes us able to meet the environmental.
I see.
And I think they've got some kind of precious metals in them that are scarce, mm-hmm. or the Chinese control them or something. I'm not really sure. But they're having difficulty sourcing that.
So that economist was specifically talking about the trucking industry.
The trucking business. He said that the next 5 years for logistics is going to be kind of a boom time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would believe that for sure. And I think that people also realize just how important it is.
Let's hope that doesn't apply to paper towels going forward.
Or toilet paper.
Yeah, it's definitely not toilet paper.
Sure. Well, I want to go back to the very beginning when we were talking, and you said something about when you first started, you didn't want to think you were going to own a business, or you knew you wanted to own a business. So you always knew you wanted to own a business.
Right.
Did you think that it would be trucking, or is this just kind of thing, something that you wanted to do?
No, at that point, I probably thought I was going to be a public accountant, you know, owning my own business or something like that. It just appeared, you know, my father was an engineer. He worked on cars a lot. So I had that kind of technical background. But as far as a diesel engine, I had absolutely no idea what one was when I went to work for a trucking company. I took a job as a service manager and knew nothing about, you know, how diesel engines worked. And frankly, you know, what I've learned is you really don't have to know, but you have to be able to know who knows,
right.
Who knows,
yeah.
And you have to be able to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's all about identifying the people who do know within your organization and then making a relationship with them and staying really close to them.
Right.
That also brings us to another question that we like to ask, is that obviously you just mentioned that you don't know everything about fixing a truck, for
right,
sure.
Right.
So you have to hire good people.
I know
people.
A lot more now than I did.
Exactly. How do you go about finding and retaining and recruiting your best people?
Well, with the, you know, honestly, we've been really lucky in that the people that were there when we bought the businesses were good, and we've had those people along. Now, I think the problem was is that the people that managed them previously did not give them enough authority to run the business. And and if you've got an accountant, you know how accountants are, right? They're they like to be involved, and they like to. So, I've really had to change the way I manage people. In that, I don't need to tell them how to do something. You know, we need to give them overall goals and strategies and say, you may do it differently than I do, but as long as you get to the same place, I'm okay with that. So I think more than anything, we've changed the way that those people manage, and it's given them freedom to grow. The guy who manages our Tupelo store, Brian Austin, was a technician, but he was extremely sharp. You know, we moved him into sales. He knew about the shop being a technician, so he became a service manager. So we've just kind of given him more and more responsibility, and he's always shown the ability to take that responsibility and succeed. And he's probably one of the best general managers that we have in the company today. So you don't have to, you know, get a guy with an MBA or, you know, that's not really what we're looking for. We're looking for a person that understands the business. I don't care if they, you know, it'd be nice if they had an MBA, but they're not, you know, most of them don't. But just giving them the authority and the ability to manage the business properly is kind of where we go.
So you mentioned, you know, your improvement as a manager, as a leader. What impacted you to make those changes?
Well, size of the business, for one thing. I mean, when we were four stores, we could kind of do that. Tommy and I could do that. Tommy could manage the whole sales staff. You know, I could work on the financial side and basically keep control of everything. But when you go from 4 to 10, I mean, you just got too many people, right, and you have to delegate or you'll go crazy. Or you'll either go crazy or you'll limit the amount of growth that you can have. So, I mean, that's probably the biggest learning experience I've had over the last 15 years is that, you know, if you don't let people have authority and responsibility, you're going to be what you are. And it's probably going to lead to your failure, quite honestly.
Oh, that's great advice. That's for sure. How would you describe the culture of your company?
You know, truck dealerships, I think, have a bad reputation. You know, it's greasy. People don't want to be there. But you've been to our new facility.
It's not that way at all.
It's state of the art. And it's becoming more and more technical. You know, every one of our technicians has a computer, and the first thing they do is plug into the truck and basically diagnose. So it's a lot less grease monkey type of business. You know, I'll meet with John Doe, who owns one truck out of Jonesboro, Arkansas, one day, and the next day I'll be meeting with the director of FedEx Express. I mean, it's a very interesting, there's something different every day. It's a very interesting business, and the breadth of customers within the business is very interesting. But I don't really know how to define it. I mean, we're kind of good old boy, redneck, you know, that kind of thing, but it's family is what it is. I mean, Tommy always says we're inbred. You know, Tommy's two kids work in the business. My kid work in the business. If you go to somebody in the Memphis store and ask them, they're probably related to somebody else that's in another department. And what we found is that if you find good people and they recommend you somebody, or, you know, they're generally going to be good. But yeah, we're very family oriented. I know, you know, if I don't know your name in the Memphis store, you're relatively new. You know, Tommy and I walk through the shop every day. We talk to people. We know who their families are. We know who their kids are. You know, we've tried to, you know, we're a big company, but we've tried to make it feel small and make it feel more family oriented. So I guess if you were going to ask me what the culture is, it's family.
Mm. I think that's a great, very good culture for sure to have. So I was just thinking about what's one of the things that it's not really a mistake, but I would almost think it'd be you should have moved from Brooks a lot earlier if you were going to say.
No, it was a huge thing. Yeah, we didn't know. I mean, we didn't know what we didn't know. You know, what is it? Field of dreams. If you build it, they will come, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But Tommy and I, we thought we had built for 10 years out. You know, we wouldn't. And now we're actually talking about expanding parking at this point in time because we've gotten more involved in the trailer business. So, you know, maybe us upgrading that facility has kind of led us down this path. But that was a huge mistake. We probably, now, I don't know that we had the wherewithal to do it, you know.
Hindsight's 2020, as
yeah,
they
well,
say,
in,
right?
Well, in 07, we were trying to make payroll, you know. We didn't, Tommy or I neither came with a whole lot of equity into the business. We borrowed most of the money. So we were very highly leveraged initially. So we probably couldn't afford to do the Mall of Memphis project until we did it. But it's turned out much better than we would have ever thought.
It's interesting because a lot of businesses get commoditized, right?
Right.
So it's all competition about pricing.
Correct.
But a lot of times when it starts to go low like that, where the services get low and the prices get low, then somebody steps up,
right,
creates a new version of it that's better than everybody else, and then everybody realizes that they'd rather have that better version than the cheaper version.
Correct. And service is king. I mean, there isn't a lot of difference. I mean, if you ask me, Freightliner produces the best truck in the world and always has, and they control the market. You know, they're a 45% market share OEM, which is pretty substantial.
Sure.
Well, 40 to 45, kind of depending on what truck you're talking about. But the only thing that differentiates us from Summit, or I guess now Rush, is service levels. And that's kind of what our elite support process is we call it throughput. So we track the from when you ride up a truck to when you exit the building is throughput. And we track 24-hour throughput. We track 48-hour throughput and 72-hour throughput. And that's really, it's your profits will follow throughput, meaning that customers will beat your door down if you can get their truck out faster.
Right, because for them, it's money.
Of course.
They can't have a truck, they can't work.
Yeah, I mean, it's thousands of dollars a day if they're down. You know, not to mention the cost that they have, you know, being in a hotel or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. What's Tommy's background?
Tommy was born and raised here. He's been in truck sales pretty much all his career. His father was a truck salesman at Delta Ford, which was down on Brooks Road. So his family has always been involved in the truck business forever. So, and when, you know, our partnership worked really well because he was kind of the sales guy and I was kind of the operations finance guy. So he never had any concerns about what I did, and I never really had any concern because he was, you know, we had worked together as VPs before. So we, you know, we trusted each other implicitly. And it's, you know, partnerships, people always say partnerships are extremely hard. Tommy's and I's has been really, really easy. You know, we've always, I'm not saying we don't meddle in, you know, his sandbox every once in a while or question this or that, but we don't take it as insulting or, you know, we're just trying to get to the best decision for the company. So he's a great guy. You know, he's probably, you know, he's my best friend. You know, if my kids were in trouble or if I was in trouble, I would want Tommy to help my family.
Yeah.
You know, that it's that kind of, you know, he's a brother as much as he is a partner.
I was going to say, he's family.
Yeah,
very much so. Definitely do that.
Yeah.
Well, I know y'all have the unique ability to be able to bounce ideas off of each other because mm-hmm. you do have a partnership. But did you ever have any other mentors that meant a lot to you along the way?
Yeah. Dan Stevens was kind of my mentor. And today we're a partnership that is managed. You know, I'm the CEO, but there's basically five partners that manage the business. And we're regional in scope. So we have a Central Texas president. We have a West Texas president. We have a Texarkana president. And then Tommy manages TAG and MoTag. So he's a president as well. Mm-hmm. And then a CFO as well. So Dan retired right around the time that the merger took place. He was kind of the COO of the company. It was kind of his idea to do the combination. And he really taught me everything I would ever know about a truck dealership, but also how to inspiring people. I mean, he was probably one of the more inspirational people that I've ever been around. And he's had really high integrity, and it really pushed me and to make your actions and your words match.
That's great. Yeah. A very important person in your life, for
correct.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
What about other learning processes or strategies? Did you, you know, read some books or?
Well, you know, I got my master's early on when I was still in Dallas. But probably from a career standpoint, I went to something called the Center for Creative Leadership. It was in Colorado. It was actually in Colorado Springs. And it basically was a coming to Jesus meeting about, hey, this is who you are. This is how you manage. This is how people, and it was 360, meaning that people that worked for you did, you didn't know
gave
who they were,
feedback.
but they gave feedback on uh-huh. how you managed. And, mm-hmm. and that was kind of an eye-opening deal in that people didn't really feel like I was giving them enough control and that I was trying to tell them how to build the watch, you know, not give him, you know. So that was probably the biggest eye-opener for me that, you know, I tend to be eyes dotted, T's crossed.
Mm-hmm. And you're an accountant.
Yeah, exactly. If I wouldn't have gone to that, I don't know that I would be where I am today.
Interesting. And what year did you do that process?
That was probably 03,
okay.
04. You know, and I thought I could control everything at that point in time. But, I mean, understanding that people look at you and say, you know, I'm not really going to work for you for a very long time because you don't really trust me. Or, you know, hearing somebody that you respect and like and trust tell you that, you know, you're holding me back. That's really not good news, or it wasn't good news to me.
It's always interesting that, you know, the way to become a better leader is to become a better person.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
And you got to really focus on what's wrong and how to fix it to get to that point.
Well, and, you know, just understanding that accuracy was very important to me, and how you got to the result, to me, was more important, or as important as the result itself.
Right.
Knowing my tendency towards that, I had never really realized that before. I just thought I was, you know, unstoppable.
Yeah.
Of course.
But seeing that, and if it would have just been one person that said it, I probably wouldn't have changed me.
Right.
But everybody said it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had like 6 people tell me that, you know, I had my thumb on them all the time and was restricting their growth.
Well, what really was impressive is the fact that you took that feedback and did something about it.
Well, I don't know that it's impressive as much as it is fear. You know, my goal was to eventually manage a larger organization, and I knew that, you know, I would never get there if I didn't change. So I knew that if I didn't do something, I wasn't going to get to where I wanted to be. So, and it's really cool seeing people exceed your expectations. I mean, so I kind of looked back then, I was kind of looking at it through my eyes, not through their eyes. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So seeing some people that you've given, you know, the rope to succeed, and not only succeed, but exceed your expectations and their expectations. That's the biggest part. Seeing them say, man, I'm amazed to be in the position that I'm in is really cool. I mean, that's the most fun. I mean, that's better than the dollars, honestly.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you took that advice and that you went with that, but what advice would you have if somebody came to you and said, Gary, I'm thinking about starting a business? What would you say to them?
Wow. I should have put some more thought into this conversation.
Well, the easy answer is don't get into trucking because I'm already there.
Right? Yeah. Find a new space.
I don't know. Be sure you're committed to it, because you think you know what the risks are. You don't really know what the risks are. You know, I'll tell you a story. So when we went to do the deal, we went to Little Rock to sign the documents, and we were meeting with our banker, and it's Daimler Truck Finance, so it's part of, you know, Mercedes. And they handed me these contracts, you know, and I started reading the contracts, you know, that what I was signing up for. Yeah. And, you know, page 2, I was going, you know, I looked at the guy and I said, I'm not signing these agreements. And he said, well, you're not going to own the business. And I said, well, I'm giving up my house, my, you know, this, that. I mean, you basically got recourse on everything that I own. Yep, that's the way you're going to get the note. And so, you know, the risks are larger than you think they are, especially, and they're even more magnified if you leverage to get the business bought. Now, you know, the business that we initially bought has been in Memphis since the 50s. I mean, it's been around forever and ever. So I didn't really have any doubt that the business could sustain itself, you know, over time. You know, the Barton Group created generational wealth for their group. Schwebe obviously did on the international side. But it's more risky than you think, and there are going to be things that you don't anticipate. So the first thing I would do is have more equity than you think you need. But if you don't, you better figure out your operation pretty quickly and your bank statement pretty quickly and understand, you know, control, because you're going to have to control to conserve the capital until you get to a point where you can afford to invest, you know, lots of money. But it's probably the most, you know, I couldn't imagine myself still being an employee now. If I were working for a big company or whatever, I think I'd feel like I was being strangled. You know, it's nice to have. That's the best part about it. You know, you can make a difference in people's lives, but you don't really have, you know, you don't have people watching over you all the time. So it's very fulfilling. It's frightening. You know, it's risky, and I'm sure you know that as well. it's the best, like you said, best of both worlds. I mean, you got the, you know, and frankly, since 2000, since we got past the real estate, you know, 2010 timeframe, we don't worry about, you know, managing every cent. I mean, we used to, but we don't, we're not really, we don't. And we take a lot more risks now than we did back then, because if the risk went the wrong way, we probably wouldn't have gotten out of it. But now, you know, we have the equity in the business that we can.
Sure. So based on your experience, do you think that entrepreneurs are born or can be taught?
I don't think I was an entrepreneur when I was born. Yeah, I think there are people that are predisposed to it, I would say. But I think you've got to work your way there. And I think you have to have a passion. I mean, you got to be passionate about it, obviously. But, you know, trust but verify is a good thing to have, because people will take advantage of you. People steal from you. I mean, and people will steal from you and not think they're stealing from you. You know what I mean? I deserve this. Or you got to watch those things. In Barlow World times, they had somebody embezzling from them, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And, you know, those things happen. You know, Jay
Myers. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you saw his TED Talk or whatever, but,
yes, I have.
You know, he had that happen and it put his family at risk. And so, you know, if you're working for somebody, they're paying your way. If you work for yourself, you got to make sure that you can pay your way. So, I mean, you have to protect yourself. You know, you worry about the checkbook a lot more than you did or you would if you were working for someone.
Sure, sure.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Well, where do you see yourself and TAG in the next 10 years?
Well, my daughter's working there now, so I have to stay like for the rest of my life. I don't know that we'll get much bigger. We have a couple of acquisition targets, but they're really more from a protection standpoint. We're kind of protecting our flanks from other dealers or from other competitors, or we have customers in certain areas that we want to serve. So we're going to try to get in their area. We could be a couple of more dealerships. I don't think we'll be a $2 billion business. You know, we're not going to double our size again for a while, I wouldn't think. So,
unless Lauren wants to.
Well, yeah, or Abby.
That's right. You got another one that's still in college.
That's right. But, I think we'll grow. I mean, you know, we'll probably go, you know, grow 10 to 15% a year or something like that. And that's kind of our goal. But, you know, massive, you know, doubling in size or something like that's really not. Honestly, it wouldn't be as fun to us, the partners of Tintex. Uh-huh. We like to know the people that we work with. We don't want it to become so big that we can't know people's name or walk around and have a conversation with them and care about them. And I think the customers will suffer if it becomes that, if it becomes a corporate type of structure, mm-hmm. or we sell out to somebody else or take a venture capital partner or something like that. It's just not, I think we're probably as big as we can manage currently, and we'll just be looking to grow, you know, organically, basically.
So you're originally from Texas,
uh-huh.
but you've got a Memphis Tigers shirt on.
I do, yeah.
What excites you about Memphis these days?
There's big things coming to Memphis. I mean, the whole Ford deal is going to be huge. And it's going to be huge for our business as well, because there's going to be people hauling batteries on trucks or parts, you know, car parts and that type of stuff. So from a logistics standpoint, I personally think Memphis is going to be a Nashville in the making is what I see. Frankly, I think it'll be more sustainable than Nashville, because Nashville's so entertainment and we're not making stuff or they're not making stuff. It's more a, you know, entertainment and food and bachelorette parties or whatever, you know.
For sure.
We're actually going to be building stuff.
Right.
And I think people are going to come. I think people are coming here.
For those who don't know the details, can you explain the Ford opportunity?
It's my understanding they're building a battery plant and an EV vehicle production facility.
Right.
That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's both. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly. I guess it's in Fayette County
here and Jackson, and I'm not exactly sure where.
Yeah.
Yeah. But all of that, I mean,
yeah, but it's a huge investment. And
it's a huge investment.
I think they're looking to hire 5,000 people. Is that the number?
It's at least. No, yeah. I think it's a lot more than that. Yeah. Than five, but it's going to be huge. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard eight, but I don't know if that's right or not.
You know, and I was thinking about that also, just out of curiosity, do y'all have electric trucks? Do you?
We do. Daimler produces an eCascadia. It's an all-electric vehicle. You know, they really don't have it figured out yet, and it really doesn't. It's going to be an interesting situation. So there's basically long-haul trucking, and then there's short-haul trucking. And what they call P&D, pickup and delivery. So the Amazon trucks that you see coming through your neighborhoods every day, those will eventually be electric. And that's a great application for them. The FedEx panel vans that come through every day, they'll be electric.
Because they can be charged locally overnight.
Correct. They'll park somewhere overnight and they'll have a charging facility that they can plug into. Long-haul trucks are going to be hard to do unless the charging infrastructure creates itself. But the question is, who's going to pay for that? So, you know, I don't see, you know, the petrol stations, unless they get a lot of government subsidy, you know, building a charging station for a truck. But what if you don't have enough charging stations? I mean, what happens? Well, you wind up with a truck that's down that has to be towed somewhere to be charged.
The last thing we need is more supply chain disruption.
Correct. So, I mean, I think diesel is going to be with us for a while from a long haul perspective. I think all the P&D is going to go. So we actually produce what's called a yard spotter. So all of these warehousing facilities have vehicles. They have trucks that move trailers from opening to opening, right? So when they get a trailer empty, they have to move that trailer. So they have trucks on the lot that move those trailers around from place to place, and they're called yard spotters. At FedEx, they call them switchers, because you're switching, you know, from one warehouse to the other. So we're building those from scratch using Dana. Dana's a producer of transmissions and axles and that type of stuff. We're using Dana products and building an electric vehicle. And we're going to use that same technology to build panel vans for FedEx Ground and for FedEx Express. So we're actually, I mean, we thought it made sense for us to know kind of what's going on from a battery standpoint, because it's really going to be probably 40 to 50% of our market in the future. I don't know. Something's going to have to change. Either the batteries are going to have to get much, much better for it to work over the road, or there's going to have to be some kind of tech, you know, revolution, you know, to change it. I don't foresee it. I mean, Tommy's got a Tesla, so, you know.
He's already embraced it.
Yeah, we're testing it as we go.
What's your take on autonomous driving?
I mean, it's all about the insurance on that deal. I think it can work. It's just going to be when an accident happens, who takes responsibility for it. So if Tesla creates the system that is the autonomous vehicle, if it fails and it runs into somebody and kills them, is it Tesla's fault, or is it the guy who bought the car from Tesla? I don't know. I think the insurance industry is going to have to figure that out, and I don't know. You know, what I see from a truck standpoint, to me, the solution is very close to a train, meaning that there are going to be lanes at some point on highways where autonomous is allowed, and they're going to be in that lane. And if you crash into somebody, you crash into another autonomous vehicle, and then, you know, they can battle to the death or whatever. You know, and they've got them now where they pair trucks. So you'll have an autonomous vehicle behind a vehicle that's being driven by a driver, but it basically tracks the driver. So it's kind of a both.
Now, would we see that on the highway at times?
No, they test it.
Okay.
They're testing it, but it's mostly the Skunk Works facility for Daimler's in Portland, so it's more northeast than, or northwest, I'm sorry, than down here. I think there's a long way to go on autonomous. I mean, I think it's 10 years out, maybe more than that. Right. And it's not that the technology's not there. It's that we don't know what to do with that.
Right, the application of that technology.
Yeah, we don't know who's going to take responsibility for what.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, you know, because we did talk about Memphis and your company, and one of the important things for members of the Society of Entrepreneurs is that your company gives back in the community. Mm-hmm. And I know that TAG has a great reputation of doing that. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we support the university, obviously. I would assume anybody who's gone to a football game knows the TAG First Down, but we support the university a lot. And we try to support organizations that do good things and maybe do good things for people that work for us or that don't have insurance. So we support Church Health. You know, we actually sell trucks to St. Jude Youth Villages and support them charitably as well. I'm a member of the St. George's board. And, you know, the reason that I was involved in that is because of the Memphis campus here where, you know, they take disadvantaged kids and try to get them into better opportunities for school. You know, I'm on the Better Business Bureau board, the AutoZone Liberty Bowl board. That's more of a, I don't think that's actually a board. That's just a title they give you or whatever. But we do try, and really all through Tim Tech, we don't give to the United Way. I mean, we give to people that are here that are helping or in Waco or in, you know, Texas or, you know, in all the markets. We try to support the charities in our markets where we do business. And we don't do that because customers, you know, care about that. We do that because we love the place we live. And frankly, Memphis, you know, I go back to Dallas and I think, you know, my parents and my brother still live in Dallas and I go back to Dallas a lot. And we have a corporate office in Grapevine. So I'm there, I don't know, you know, once a month. And I'm like, would I ever go back to Dallas? And, you know, thinking about it, you know, I've lived in Dallas and Denver, a couple of places in East Texas. Memphis is the favorite place I've ever lived.
Yes.
And,
he's right.
You know,
good answer.
And, you know, when I came here, I wasn't sure about that. You know, and Brooks Road was kind of a scary place in 2007, 2005, but it's a lot better now. I mean, it's kind of night and day since I got here. You know, in the last 10 or 15 years, the improvements in those areas has sped up, and I think it's going to even, you know, speed up even more. But I, you know, I see really great things coming for the city, and really not just, I mean, I'm talking about the whole area, you know, Shelby County in general. You know, having the resources that we have, the water that we have, the port that we have, I mean, we're you know, the train, you know, the intermodal stuff.
Sure.
I mean, we can do nothing. I mean, we are vital. We are essential to this economy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be even more in the near future, I think.
And entrepreneurs, companies like you that take full advantage of that are seeing success. So let's keep doing it.
For sure. Yeah. Knock on wood.
Yeah.
Let's don't screw it up.
And this all kind of brings me to a question that we always ask, is that Memphis is kind of known for having a great entrepreneurial spirit. Why do you think that is?
You know, I really don't know, but I would say agriculture's probably got something to do with it. You know, there's cotton barons, right? You know, I've always kind of envisioned them as being kind of the gambler types and willing to take risks. And I think that's just kind of been in the Memphis, you know, DNA probably from the beginning, quite honestly. Riverboats and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, gamblers.
People willing to take a chance.
Yes, exactly.
Speaking of which, you want to tell the story about losing your poker bet?
Yeah, so I worked for Ernst & Young. I had a buddy of mine. He worked with me. He wound up quitting Ernst & Young and opened his own accounting firm. And one of the things they did was to try to fill positions. So they were like a headhunter, basically, for accounting type people. And so we were playing poker one night and he said, hey, I've got a client, you know, that needs a CFO. You know, I'd really like you to meet with him. And I said, man, I'm not interested in doing that. He goes, well, you know, let's bet the next hand on you going and interviewing with the guy. And I lost. I went on the interview, and the rest is history.
Very interesting.
Aren't you glad you didn't win that hand?
I know. It's the best bet I ever made. That's great. Yeah, you lost, but you won.
Yeah.
That's great.
Besides losing poker hands, what do you like to do for fun?
Spend time with kids. We had Sunday dinner last night with all the kids, and, you know, Abby was absent, obviously, but we've kind of adopted Lauren's roommates and some other people. So, I mean, just enjoying good food and wine with friends. And used to play tennis a lot. My knees don't allow that much anymore, but I'll play golf. I duck hunt occasionally, mostly with customers. You know, I have a lab, so that kind of stuff is interesting to me. But yeah, just spend time with my wife.
Well, and going to University of Memphis events.
Yes, that's true. We do tailgate quite a bit. And there's a story behind that. A friend of ours, kid, played for University of Memphis. I went to Texas A&M, so I'm an Aggie by training, by indoctrination.
Yeah, we won't shame you.
Yeah, but Drew Bishop is his name, and he played when Memphis really started to grow, you know, when Paxton was here and such. And we just really got addicted to the Memphis football team. Not as much, and, you know, I'm from Texas, so I'm more of a football guy than a basketball guy. So I've never really gotten into the basketball side, but we go every weekend. We tailgate and just love the Memphis games. So we've kind of adopted. They're my new Aggies, I guess.
Yeah. A little bit closer.
Yeah,
easier to get to.
Not as far of a drive, for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, what are three things that you, Gary, could not live without?
Well, my wife, one, obviously. My kids, two. And probably, I mean, I really enjoy the day-to-day involvement with all the people that I work with. It's really a blessing to be where I'm at, and, you know, just to see people happy working for you and working with you is probably the best. I mean, it's like I said, it's better than all the money, quite honestly.
Well, I think we just ended on a high note.
I think we did. I was like, well, no more questions there. That was the perfect end. Well, thank you so much, Gary. This has been a lot of fun. We've really enjoyed it. So
good. I hope I didn't break anything.
You did a perfect job.
Awesome. Yes. Awesome. Good deal.
Great interview. Thank you.
Right. Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
We hope that you enjoyed our interview with Gary Dodson. If you'd like more information on Gary, please visit our show notes.